This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Anyone who's lived through it knows that caring about an addict is as complex and fraught and debilitating as addiction itself. That's a line from journalist David Sheff's new memoir, Beautiful Boy, A Father's Journey Through His Son's Addiction. David's son Nick was addicted to methamphetamine, but also used just about every other drug. He's been sober over 2 years. David's memoir is about how Nick's addiction affected the whole family, David, his second wife, and their two younger children, Jasper and Daisy. David and Nick's mother divorced when Nick was young. After that, Nick spent most of each year with his father in San Francisco and spent holidays and summers with his mother in L.A. until he left home. Nick is 25 now. He's written a memoir about his decade of drug use. It's called Tweak, Growing Up on Methamphetamines. Both memoirs have just been published. Nick and David Sheff are my guests. Let's start with a question for David. Can you talk a little bit about how your son's personality changed when he was using meth?
He became unrecognizable. He went from being, you know, just one of the most sort of light-filled, extraordinary people I knew, and he became, you know, this ghost sort of coming in and out of the house. I mean, physically he changed. He hadn't, you know, he lost, you know, he was skin and bones, and he was jittery, and then his behavior changed. I mean, he went from being, as I said, this sort of charming, lovely, kind, open, gentle person, and he became belligerent and angry and depressed and argumentative,
and he stole from you,
and he did things that were just inconceivable that he would do. He stole from me. He stole from my wife, Karen. He stole from Jasper and Daisy. He broke into our house. He broke into friends' houses. I mean, he became someone else is all I can say. He became someone that I didn't recognize anymore.
Nick, why was meth your drug of preference? Like, when you started using it, what did it do for you that made you want more?
Well, I think that... you know, I mean, with all drugs, I sort of had this feeling, but yeah, with meth particularly was like, I'd always been really just like consumed with like worry about making sure that everybody was okay around me and that, you know, I just wanted like everyone to like me and to just be sort of perfect all the time or something. And, you know, when I started doing drugs, it really like allowed me not to care about other people or, I mean, about anything really. And it was sort of a relief for me. But meth in particular, I guess when I first tried it, it was just like this sort of focus and clarity and this feeling like all these fears and insecurities and self-doubt and everything that I'd always, you know, been so wrapped up in just disappeared. And I felt, you know, totally confident, and you know, the feeling that I'd been missing my whole life. I mean, it gave me so much, you know, strength. At least I thought, you know, and confidence.
Well, you know, you've described yourself as formerly having been thin-skinned and sensitive, you know, before the meth, and you said that meth allowed you to like be confident and to not be so worried about what other people are thinking.
Mm-hmm.
It also, at some point, like when you really became an addict, it seemed to erase any trace of empathy that you had for anybody, certainly for your family. And were you aware of that? Aware that not only weren't you like the sensitive person anymore, but that you were walking over people. You had no empathy at all. It didn't bother you. You were stealing from your family. Like, did that register on you at all? Did it mean anything?
I think it did, because I spent a lot of time when I was high talking to my friends and to myself and to anybody who would listen about how I was right and how I had the right to do this stuff. And, you know, I was justifying it all over and over. So I think I probably wouldn't have spent that much time trying to convince myself and trying to convince everyone else if there wasn't a little piece of me that was, you know, did recognize what a monster I'd turned into. But the other weird thing about crystal meth is, you know, I would do stuff like think that, you know, if I took apart my computer because it wasn't working and then took apart my cell phone, I could put it all back together with my cell phone in the computer, and then I would make this like supercomputer or something. I mean, you know, it was like stuff that really made sense to me at the time. And if you'd asked me, I would have, you know, thought that I was being totally rational. But you know, I obviously wasn't. And it just completely, you know, messes up your perception of reality. And so I think that is a big part of it, is that you just really don't know what you're doing. I mean, you think you know what you're doing, but you don't know what you're doing.
Nick, how old were you when you started using, and how long did you use?
Well, I mean, I started, like, smoking pot and stuff, and when I was, you know, I'm consistently, I guess, when I was, like, 12, I was smoking pot a lot. But, and then, you know, in high school, I'd, you know, smoke pot and drink and stuff, but not super habitually. But I guess when I was 17 was really when I started, like, smoking pot every day. And then, you know, started doing mushrooms and acid and stuff, and then ecstasy, and then cocaine, and then, you know, everything else. And so it lasted, I guess, from, you know, when I was 17, and I'm 25 now, and I have 2 years sober. So it must have been from about 17 to 23, you know, but with periods of interruption when I was in rehab or sober or whatever.
Okay. If you're just joining us, my guests are David Sheff and Nick Sheff, and they've each written memoirs. David Sheff is about his son Nick's addiction and how that affected David's life and his family's life, and Nick's book is about his own addiction. David's book is called Beautiful Boy, A Father's Journey Through His Son's Addiction. Nick's memoir is called Tweak. David, you thought the fact that you'd used drugs when you were young, and you even tried meth once, would make you a more convincing authority to your son on why he should stay away from drugs. You know, you write that your parents used to lecture you about drugs, but they were teetotalers, so it was so easy to discount what they were saying. But, you know, you came of age, in the 60s and 70s, when, you know, drugs were pretty common, LSD, marijuana. Now, you tried meth once, and your roommate who you tried it with ended up getting addicted to meth and, as a result, dying at the age of, just before his 40th birthday. So what did you try to tell Nick about the reasons why he should stay away from drugs or get off drugs?
I felt that, I thought two things. I thought, first of all, because we were close and we talked about everything, I thought I would know what was going on with him. And so when each time something dramatic happened, I was blindsided, and part of the, part of the hurt was, and part of the bafflement was that I thought I would know, and I didn't know. When I was growing up, you know, I was of the generation that, you know, when drugs were prevalent and pretty new. It was part of the culture, you know. Certainly in my crowd in high school and at the beginning of college, and there was sort of a mixed thing going on there. One of them was, you know, there was this almost a celebration. It was sort of drugs became almost a political statement. It was sort of we viewed them as if, you know, it was a way of rebelling and sort of expanding our mind and, you know, doing something positive. But very quickly, it became apparent that. That was a fantasy, and it was, so I guess I both understood the drug culture and the temptations and the sort of the peer pressure, all the different things that come into using drugs when you're a kid. So I understood what Nick was going through, but I was not naive about drugs. I was really, really worried about them and really scared about them. And I did everything that they, you know, the experts, you know, will tell you to do, which is to talk to your children about drugs. We had a lot of conversations about them. I warned Nick. I told him all the true horror stories that I knew. I told him, you know, about the seduction of drugs. It wasn't just, you know, a Nancy Reagan just say no thing. It was more complicated than that. And I thought, because I was so open about my experiences and because I did know what I was talking about, because it was not just platitudes. It was some real life, you know, stuff that I thought that it would have an impact on him. I thought that it would, I thought he would listen. I thought I would have some credibility.
Were you using anything when he was growing up?
It was interesting that I had stopped using drugs because of Nick. I used a lot of drugs when I was growing up, and when I became a parent, it no longer to me was it was no longer acceptable in my mind anymore. I had this beautiful young son who would wake up every morning with just bright eyes and just just eagerness about embracing a new day, and it was and I still had friends who used drugs, and the contrast was so shocking and so dramatic to me that it became clear that I didn't want drugs to be part of my life anymore.
Even marijuana?
I stopped smoking pot. I stopped doing everything.
Mm-hmm. Nick, what message do you think you got from your father about drugs? And what did you think of the way he gave you the message? He thought it was really convincing. Did you find it convincing?
Yeah. I mean, I think it was convincing. I mean, I know
not
that,
convincing enough.
Well, no. I mean, I think that, I believe, and I think, we probably differ on this and everything, but, I think that crystal meth is just totally disgusting. Maybe if I was a different person, I wouldn't have tried it, but I feel like it didn't have much to do with me trying it, didn't have much to do with, my dad or any lessons that he taught me or anything. I mean, I think it was more just, I don't know. I mean, I think I was always really curious, and I idolized, a lot of people who are drug addicts and heavy, users and stuff. But I don't think there was anything anyone could have done differently.
David, there's a lot of guilt feelings that you express in your memoir about your son's addiction. You worry whether it's anything you did or said or didn't do or didn't say that might have led to his addiction or prevented him from giving it up sooner. During those periods when you felt guilty, what did you feel guilty about? What were the things that you thought you might have contributed to?
I felt guilty about everything. I tried to look back in our lives and to say, what was it that ultimately caused Nick to go so out of control and to come so close to dying? Was it the divorce, when he was young? Was it the fact that I'd used drugs and that I was open about it? And, was I too liberal, and did I just give him too much, I just didn't set limits that he needed? I guess the ultimate answer is that I feel that it's unknowable what would cause a child to become so self-destructive. When you go to Al-Anon, I went to a lot of meetings and found them very useful. They say, you didn't cause it. You can't control it. You can't cure it. You can't cure it. You can't control it, I believe. You didn't cause it. I'm not 100% there yet.
Nick, when your father was blaming himself for your addiction, were you blaming him too?
Sometimes, absolutely. It's easier to blame other people than to have to look at yourself.
What did you blame when you would kind of put it all on him, or at least put some of it on him? What did you put there?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, some of it was, sure, about the divorce and moving me out of the city when I was little, and anything, just in this for the moment, refusing to let me borrow the car that night or something. I definitely spent a lot of time being really, really angry with both my parents, with everybody. And part of that, I think, was just a, another aspect of or another part of denial or whatever, not wanting to take responsibility for my actions and things. Yeah.
David, you write about all the contradictory advice you get when you're a parent with a child who's addicted. What's the strongest thing you ever did to intervene and to try to force him into rehab?
Well, one time I actually fantasized about just going out and grabbing him and throwing him in the car and driving him, because once he turned 18, I could no longer forcibly commit him into treatment in any way. I couldn't get him into a hospital unless he was a threat to himself or others, and I suppose he was at different times, but even then, from what I was told, he would stay in for a period of observation, and they wouldn't keep someone in there because they were on drugs. I had to do what was I guess only only a parent who's been through this can understand what it feels like to have a call from your child who is in tears and who's saying, I'm going to die. You have to come get me. And I said to him, I'll come get you and drive you to a hospital or drive you to a rehab. And he said, no, I can't do that again. I've been there. It doesn't work for me. And I said, well, call me when you're ready to do that. And I hung up the phone. And all I wanted to do was hang up the phone and drive to San Francisco and go get him and hold him and put him in the car and take care of him. But I didn't do that. And I did wait until he called up and he was ready to go into treatment, or in some cases, you know, ended up crawling back himself and getting himself into recovery. But
What happened that day or that night? Like, after you hung up on him, did he call back soon and say, okay, so take me to rehab?
No, he didn't. There were times, it happened more than once, actually. What happened was is that I wept. I was in, I was devastated. I worried that he would die. I worried that I would regret what I had just said. Mm-hmm. But I also knew from experience that if I were to go get him and let him come home and sleep it off and, feel better for a few days and sort of take care of him, then he would split again and he'd be high again. And I knew that the only thing that I could do was to get him into treatment to begin, even if it wasn't going to be the solution to the problem, at least for whatever time he was in a hospital or in a treatment center, there would be a it would stop the cycle. He would be off drugs for a while. And there's no easy way through this. And you just have to do the best you can.
There were times when you went to rehab willingly and times when you went against your will. Is that correct?
Yes, absolutely.
Did it make a difference to the outcome whether you went there willingly or whether you went there against your will?
No, not really. I mean, I feel like, each rehab that I went to, I feel like really helped me a lot. And I learned more and more about myself and I learned more and more about, this disease and what it takes to stay sober and how to sort of learn how to take care of yourself and love yourself and everything. Each time that I relapsed after going to treatment, I don't think that that meant that those treatment centers failed me or anything, or that it just was that I just wasn't ready, this last treatment center I went to, I was absolutely did not want to go. This is a little over 2 years ago, and I was basically coerced into treatment. And once I got there, I didn't want to stay either. I mean, it's not fun, you're being told what to do every second of the day, and you have to sleep in room with three other people. And if I could have done it without having to go to rehab, I definitely would have preferred to do that. And it's expensive too, it's hard, for sure.
A lot of people say that if you're an addict, you're not really going to be ready to stop until you've bottomed out. But you seem to hit bottom like a whole bunch of times. One of which was when your arm got so badly infected from shooting up that when you finally went to the emergency room, the doctor thought he might need to amputate your arm. Well, that somebody would need a surgeon would need to amputate your arm.
Yeah.
So how come incidents like that weren't enough to get you to think, well, I'd better stop. I'm killing myself.
Part of it again is that I think that killing myself was okay with me. I sort of knew that that was what I was doing, and I was sort of resigned to that. I guess there's a point where you feel like you've gone so far down that building your life back after having let everyone down again and having disappointed people and overdrawn your bank account and lost your cell phone and lost your job and, lost your car. And it just feels like at certain points, like to start over and to try to like rebuild my whole life again, it's just too much. And so, I might as well just ride this out till the end and just, see it through until I do die, but there was something inside of me that I guess believed that maybe things could get better somehow. Even against all, rationale or whatever. And that little bit of hope, was what I was able to hold on to. And it's gotten me here, thank God. So
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're talking about how addiction affects not only the addict, but the addict's whole family. My guest, journalist David Sheff, has written a memoir about his son Nick's addiction to methamphetamine. It's called Beautiful Boy. Nick is 25 now and has been sober for over 2 years. Nick is also with us. He's written a new memoir, too. It's called Tweak, Growing Up on Methamphetamines. When we left off, we were talking about Nick's experiences in rehab. I think one of the things that you both had trouble with in the rehab programs was the, quote, God talk. You know, in the Alcoholics Anonymous model, you look toward a higher power to give you strength. Mm-hmm. And there's a saying that goes, let go and let God. David, you describe in your memoir how you were or still are an atheist and raised Nick without religion.
I too felt guilt. I mean, you asked me about what I felt guilty for. I felt guilty for that too when we heard from some people that the only way to get sober and stay sober is to embrace that. And they tried to broaden it by saying, you know, God can be whatever you conceive him to be. It's a higher power and things like that. It was, I don't know if Nick would say that it was just an excuse to resist. But I think ultimately I learned, and I think he learned, that you could not deny some of those basic principles, including the first one, which is, you know, Nick didn't agree for a long time that he was powerless over his addiction. He thought he was in control. He had to nearly die, you know, more than once before he finally, I think, accepted that. And once you accept that, I think you're in the door.
Just to add, I think that that God thing, you know, in 12-step programs and in recovery, I think it is a huge problem, because I spent a lot of time, you know, trying so hard to practice prayer and doing all this stuff to make myself, you know, come to believe. And ultimately, you know, when I sit with myself in the quiet moments, you know, when I'm alone, you know, I don't believe. You know, I think that for people who are just fundamentally, you know, don't believe in God or any, you know, reason to this world or anything, I think that they are at a disadvantage in terms of getting help through these kind of programs. Absolutely.
But the other thing that I think is really important that we learned is that there isn't just one way. There isn't just one way to get healthy and sober and to stop using. I thought it was really – the first thing that Nick told me about when he arrived at this last program was he sat with a counselor, and the counselor said to him, you know, why are you here? And by then he was a perfect student of rehabs, and so he said what, you know, he thought they expected him to say, which is, I'm here because I'm a drug addict and an alcoholic. And the guy said, well, wait, let's why are you a drug addict and alcoholic? You know, why are you trying to kill yourself? That's what that rehab was all about. It was about trying to figure out what was going on inside. And that's what, everybody, you know, it's different for everybody. But for Nick, I think that's what he says, that those 3 months were essential.
So did that program not rely on the higher power principle?
It didn't rely on it completely, no. I mean, there was definitely that was there, and that was a part of it. But there was a lot of, like, experimental therapies and stuff that they did there. And, you know, I sort of got to really go back and sort of re-experience some of the traumas that I experienced growing up and sort of relive them and grieve them, you know, for the first time, really allow myself to grieve them and to come to understand who I am and that and to learn, you know, as trite as it sounds or whatever, to learn how to love myself. And, you know, today, like, I mean, I don't want to kill myself, you know, I don't at all. I mean, I love my life and stuff, and yeah, it doesn't have anything to do with a higher power for me, you know, but for a ton of people, it does, and I'm certainly not, you know, dissing anybody that feels that way, absolutely.
David, did you find, you know, something that you could describe as a higher power?
I learned to define it in a way that worked for me, which is it's something about our humanity. When I went to Al-Anon meetings, I was told by someone, before this is over, you will believe in God. That transformation didn't happen to me, but I do believe in prayer, it was a way that I got through. I never planned to pray. I never said, I'm going to pray. I'm going to do what they told me. But all of a sudden, there were moments where I found myself praying, and it was a way to get through.
What does prayer mean to you if you don't believe in a God?
You know, it's a really good question, and I don't even know the answer. I guess it was a reflection of how desperate I was, that unconsciously, without saying, I'm going to pray, I was saying, please, please, please save Nick. Please help heal my son. I remember that's what I chanted to myself over and over and over again. And it was maybe a way just to stay sane and to stay focused on something that, you know, that I could hold on to. Or maybe I was, you know, hedging my bets. Maybe I was praying in a way, you know, in case someone out there was listening.
Nick, you make it seem that there's the part of what saved you from your meth addiction was a degree of self-knowledge that you were helped to acquire in your last rehab. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, was the rehab in which you were diagnosed with having bipolar disorder, which is basically manic depression. Did that help, getting that diagnosis and then getting the medication to deal with the diagnosis?
Yes. I mean, absolutely. You know, it's so – I think it's like – very, very subtle. And, you know, I am on I'm on two different medications, and one of them is a bipolar medication. And it's, you know, it's so subtle. I mean, I couldn't even tell you necessarily, you know, what the difference is or how it's helping me. But I think it's definitely, you know, one little piece of the puzzle in terms of learning how to be able to live with yourself, you know, a little bit more. And yeah, so I think... think that if you need it, you know, if you get a really good doctor that's that knows what they're doing, you know, and they can help you, I think that's awesome. Absolutely.
It's sort of a you know, something I think people know about. People talk about this idea that a lot of people who use drugs are indeed self-medicating for whatever, depression, bipolar disorder, many, many other disorders. And I think the research shows that 70 to 80% of people who wind up in rehab are diagnosed with something else. And I was told that kids with bipolar disorder, a person with bipolar disorder, would gravitate to methamphetamine specifically because there are some similarities in the drugs that there's some sort of, you know, they're in the same family or something. I mean, that of the drugs that actually treat bipolar disorder. Nick tells a story in his book that to me is so profound, and it's done in just a beautiful way, I think. He came to see us, Karen, my wife, and Jasper and Daisy. We hadn't seen Nick for a long time, and Karen said, you know, let's invite Nick to join us. We were going on a family vacation, and so Nick came over to see us, and we were hanging out. We had a really good time. It was, you know, we talked a lot. Nick was very open, and he talked to the kids about what had been going on, and was, you know, sort of, he apologized to them in a way that was, I think it was just so meaningful to them and to Karen and to me, and we had a really good time. And then he describes the day before he was leaving, he got just really annoyed by us. And he talked about, you know, he was ready to kill me. And all of a sudden it hit him that tomorrow I'm leaving. Oh, that's what's going on here. I don't really want to leave. Part of me wants to stay here and be a child again and be, you know, with my family. And so I'm sort of, and then all of a sudden he said that I feel better now. And he went back, and the rest of the trip was great. And we had a really nice last day. But then he said, what just happened? He said, another time in my life, that moment would have just been the beginning of a descent, and it would have been the kind of descent that would have ended up in, you know, going out to have a drink or to get some pot and then some meth. And just quickly, he said, oh, could it be the fact that I'm on this new medication? And I just thought it was such a beautiful description of the way that it all works together.
Well, let me read another family moment, kind of similar, from Nick's memoir. And he writes, this is when he's visiting, David, you and your family in San Francisco. And he's on the verge of leaving. It's time to leave and go back to L.A. So he's describing an overwhelming sense of sadness and depression taking hold of him as he leaves you and your family. And he says, I guess mostly it has to do with that same old desire I have to be a part of this wonderful family my dad has created with Karen, your wife. And then he says, but then gradually I realized that all those feelings of dreading leaving are being replaced with just wanting to get the hell out of there. Suddenly, I can't wait to leave, get back on my own, not to have to deal with this cutesy, overprotected, sugar-coated world of my dad's family. They're keeping their children so naive, so unable to cope with the hardships of the real world, and real is capitalized. Nick, what struck you as, you know, that you love this family, this special family that your dad created that you so much want to be a part of, and then you have this opposite feeling that it's fake, it's cutesy, your younger siblings can't deal with the hardships of the world. Would you explain that?
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, you know, in my life, when I when there's a feeling of pain or uncomfortability, whatever the word is, you know, I guess, you know, my initial reaction is to start criticizing whatever it is that you know, that I feel uncomfortable about or whatever. So it's like, you know, oh well, I really, you know, I really do feel a lot of pain, you know, and I've had felt a lot of longing of wishing that, you know, I could be a part of, you know, like really, really a part of my dad's family, and you know, just, I mean, you know, another sibling with my little brother and sister, and could just, you know, go to school with them and, you know, do all the things that they do and do swim team and stuff. And it's sad for me that, you know, sometimes that I've had to deal with different things and that I didn't, you know, get that same upbringing and everything. So so I think that there is a, you know, there's a piece of me that you know, when I see something that causes me pain like that, I just want to tear it apart, you know, making myself feel better by disconnecting from it and, you know, criticizing it and sort of putting it in its place so that I can feel superior or something.
So when you call the world of your father's family cutesy and overprotected, because I will point out that you had, even though your parents were divorced, you had a pretty privileged upbringing. I mean, both of your parents lived quite comfortably, and you know what I mean? You were still so protected from a lot of things, and so given so many opportunities.
Yes, that's true. Absolutely. And I'm super grateful for that. Yeah, I mean, I'm super grateful for you know, my upbringing. I think, you know, again, when I was at this last treatment center and stuff and I was talking a lot about, you know, the way that I was raised and everything, you know, I think it's you know, there are two sides to it. I think I'm really, really grateful. I mean, I had so many incredible experiences and, you know, I mean, my dad has always been like, you know, one of my best friends, you know, and my mom and I are so close and stuff. So, I mean, I really have been really lucky. I think there was a lot of the fast-paced lifestyle that I was living in that was, you know, confusing and stuff for me. It doesn't necessarily mean it was bad. It just was confusing. And so, you know, I think that I was struggling with my own pain and suffering and everything. You know, maybe it wasn't, you know, I mean, obviously I'm, you know, so much more privileged than so many people, you know, and I understand that, you know, and I mean, it's you know, it's a confusing thing because I know people, you know, one of my best friends right now, you know, I mean, he grew up just with nothing, you know, and you know, basically didn't even have either parent around, and you know, and he's this great guy living this great life, and he's never been a drug addict or, you know, done anything. So I mean, it's certainly, you know, you can't blame your upbringing or anything. I mean, I don't believe absolutely.
My guests are David Sheff and Nick Sheff. David is a journalist who's just written a memoir about his son's addiction to methamphetamine, and his son Nick has just written a memoir about his own addiction. David's book is called Beautiful Boy, A Father's Journey Through His Son's Addiction, and Nick's book is called Tweak, Growing Up on Methamphetamines. David, there's another part of your story, which is while you're going through all of this with your son, and he's kind of, you know, getting deeper and deeper into a hole with his habit, you had a brain hemorrhage, and the doctors had to drill a hole in your skull to relieve the brain pressure from the swelling. You lost your memory for a while, and you describe how you can't remember your name. You can't remember who the president is, which the doctors are always asking you, who's the president? You don't know the date. What you're remembering is that you're worried about your son. How's Nick? Where's Nick? You want to remember his phone number because you want to give the phone number to the doctors to call him. You can't remember the phone number.
Yeah.
What does it say to you that when you couldn't remember your name, you remembered that you were worried about Nick?
Yeah, it was a nightmare to have been in that, you know, to be in that ICU, and it was I was aware when the doctor asked me my name that I didn't know the answer, but I knew that I should know. That's a question that I should be able to answer. But somehow through, you know, some deeper, more, I don't know, maybe a primal place inside me, there was this knowledge that my son was in danger. And I was desperate and I was out of control. The nurses who took care of me all night would tell you that I was a lunatic, you know, with this obsession with trying to find out if Nick was okay. I wanted to call him. I thought that I had to call him. It just told me something about what it means to be a parent, about how deeply connected we are to our kids. It was deeper even than my identity, the sense that my son was out there somewhere and that he was in danger.
Well, the way you describe it, there's another revelation you had as a result of the brain hemorrhage, which is that you realized that you could die and that your children, including Nick, they were going to live with you or without you. And what did you realize after that realization?
One of the things that I realized that, and it was a revelation because, of course, intellectually I knew this, but I think deeply emotionally I didn't know that Nick or Jasper and Daisy, you know, are separate from me and they will have lives separate from me. And I think parents, at least some parents, at least have a hard time with that idea, at least have a hard time accepting it and living it. And there was a sense, you know, through this whole process, it wasn't just through my hemorrhage, but through watching Nick, I realized ultimately that as much as I would do everything in my power to save the life of my son, it wasn't up to me ultimately. It was up to him. And it was a hard, hard, hard lesson. But it was essential because it's true. And I think that, it shifted things in a way that I think was really good for us, for our relationship. Because in a way, when I no longer was trying to carry all the burden of Nick's recovery in a very subtle but still important way, I think it shifted the burden back on his own shoulders. Was maybe one of the very small, maybe a very small piece in the puzzle that, you know, of things that have happened since then that have shifted things so dramatically for him.
Well, listen, congratulations to both of you on the books and on the sobriety, Nick, and, you know, good luck with, you know, with continuing it and everything. I wish you well. Thank you both so much.
Thank you, Terry.
Thanks, Terry.
David Sheff's new memoir is called Beautiful Boy, A Father's Journey Through His Son's Addiction. Nick Sheff's memoir is called Tweak, Growing Up on Methamphetamines. Here's the John Lennon song that inspired the title of David's memoir, Beautiful Boy.
Close your eyes. Monster's gone, he's on the run, and your daddy's here. Beautiful, 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 beautiful boy. Beautiful, 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 beautiful boy. Before you go to sleep, say a
The late Axel Cordy was a Paris-born Austrian filmmaker best known internationally for a trilogy made in the 1980s called Where To and Back, about the fate of Jewish refugees during the Third Reich. After years of being hard to see, the trilogy was screened in January at Lincoln Center to sold-out audiences and is now available on DVD from the National Center for Jewish Film, a nonprofit organization dedicated to restoring, preserving, and presenting films about Jewish history and culture. Our critic at large, John Powers, saw the films when they came out and says they're so good, he's been dying to see them again ever since.
Back in the 1980s, I once spent a long afternoon trying to convince the L.A. film critics to give their best film prize to Where To and Back, an Austrian trilogy based on the life of its screenwriter, George Stefan Troller, a Viennese Jew who'd fled the Nazis. I failed, not least because almost nobody had seen it. To this day, most people have never even heard of these movies, although they offer one of the richest, most sophisticated portraits of Nazi-era flight, emigre life, and post-war rebuilding. Luckily, all that should change now that the films have finally come out on DVD. The trilogy opens with God Doesn't Believe in Us Anymore, a gripping tale that starts right after Kristallnacht. It follows a young Viennese Jew, Ferry, who decides to get out of Austria. As he goes from Prague to Paris, we meet a rich range of characters, including Jewish refugees, all briskly individualized, a German dissident brilliantly played by Armin Mueller-Stahl, and some not-so-decent Frenchmen who put him in a camp. Ferry eventually escapes and takes a boat to America. The second film is called Santa Fe, and it begins with a new hero, Freddie, arriving in New York during the war, with fantasies of being a cowboy out west. Instead, he's just one of a boatload of Jewish refugees struggling in an America that doesn't really want them. At one point, he's reduced to stealing bits of bread tossed to the pigeons. As Freddie slowly becomes an American, we get a remarkable picture of New York's emigre community, with its nostalgias, delusions, face-saving lies, and bursts of generosity from those so battered by life they would seem to have no kindness left to share. By Welcome in Vienna, the trilogy's undeniable masterwork, Freddie is a Yank soldier riding into Vienna. But his old home has been destroyed in every sense. Vienna is now a city rife with moral ambiguity and the personalities such ambiguity engenders. There's the disillusioned communist Adler, the charming black marketeer Trashensky, and the lovely Nazi's daughter Claudia, who Freddie can't help but fall for. This is the new Austria, where everyone, from crooks to governments, rewrites the past for immediate gain. I'm not joking when I say that this movie's intelligence and complexity make that other great post-war Vienna film, The Third Man, seem naive by comparison. That's because the whole trilogy, which was directed by Axel Corti, is steeped in the worldliness that once made Vienna the great international city of wit, conversation, lacerating irony, and psychosexual exploration. These qualities defined the Viennese directors who wound up in Hollywood, Eric von Stroheim, Billy Wilder, Fritz Lang. And as critic David Thompson has noted, Axel Corti, who died in 1993, was their heir. Indeed, Where to and Back glows with that city's sensibility, from its unsparing view of human frailty to the haunting use of the adagio from Schubert's string quintet. What makes the trilogy great is that it does two hard things at once. First, it takes an epic story and gives it an ordinary human scale, free of hokum or obvious lessons about how the Holocaust was horrible. Of course it was. Rather than play up the melodrama, their version of Kristallnacht isn't full of run-amok Nazis or wailing shopkeepers. It's just worried old women sweeping up glass. Nor do they turn their characters into generic victims. They're fascinated by individuals and what life does to them. Santa Fe begins with a young Jewish woman getting off the refugee boat, rushing to the car of a waiting aunt, and then riding off, without helping any of her shipmates. Having cheated death, she just wants to get away. And it's part of Corti's brilliance that we don't judge her for ignoring her fellow refugees. We understand. Some people help, some don't. And by the end, we also understand history's power to carry individuals along willy-nilly. Freddie was driven from Vienna by forces bigger than him. And when he returns, history's still making the rules. Back in Vienna, he still finds himself standing on historical quicksand. While the U.S. government is busy making deals with ex-Nazis to fight the communists, the opportunistic Austrians try to blame everything on the Germans. They want to go back to business as usual. Disillusioned and worn, Freddie does not. But he's not quite sure what to do. And in this, he's a quintessentially modern hero. In Where to and Back, Corti and Troller wind up posing the question that we all must face. How do we live happy, decent, self-defining lives when we are like corks bobbing on the waves of history?
John Powers is film critic for Vogue. He reviewed three films by the late filmmaker Axel Corti. They're now out on DVD.